Welcome to Intelligent Medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Once again, it's time for what, for many of you, is your favorite Intelligent Medicine segment of the week. It's our Q&A, our weekly Q&A with Layla. Layla Mutin, of course, is nutritionist at the Hoffman Center. And she joins me on a weekly basis to field some of our most challenging questions from you, the listeners. Just to remind you, a way to get your questions to us, radioprogram@AOL.com. Radioprogram@AOL.com is the place you can email your questions. And additional thing I'll mention is that if you wish to have your question answered on my live weekly radio program, just give us a phone number where we can reach you on the weekend. Our program is heard from noon to 2 p.m. Saturdays Eastern Time, and we will call you and we will put you on the air. So those of you, you know, if you don't want to, you know, want to remain anonymous, you just want us to read your question and answer it here on the podcasts, well, don't bother sending a phone number. If you want us to call you, we will speak to you live on the air from noon to 2 on a Saturday. Just give us your number, radioprogram@AOL.com. That's how you get through. All right. So we got lots to talk about today. How you doing? How you holding up?
Great. I'm good, Dr. Hoffman. How are you doing?
Are you saying that because you have a positive attitude?
I heard it's going to be up in the 30s this week. That's nice and balmy, huh?
Yes, indeed. We're going to get out of our Bermuda shorts and our white beater t-shirts, and we're going to go out. Actually, they had an underwear run in New York City this weekend. I guess it's just really getting cabin fever here in Manhattan, and so mostly the young kids wore bras and panties and jockey shorts and boxers, and they went for a nice charity run this weekend. So,
oh my goodness!
And the temperature was about 18 degrees, I think. So I guess that'll keep you at a brisk pace. And you know, before we get to our questions, just mention this article from Associated Press. Much of the nation has been grappling with severe winter weather for the past few weeks, and there is an uptick in the diagnosis of seasonal affective disorder. That's why I was asking, you say great, you must like the winter, but a lot of it's taken a toll on a lot of people. A lot of people are feeling kind of gloomy, pent up.
I'm not fond of the winter. I'm looking forward to warmer weather, which is supposed to happen kind of soon.
Okay.
So I'm looking forward to that. But yes, I have cabin fever as well. Enough is enough.
I mean, it's an unprecedented amount of snow. I mean, I've lived here in New York since 1969. First grew up in California. So I never quite got used to New York winters, even though I've been here for 40 years or so. Man, it's a lot of snow, a lot of cold days. The cold prevents the snow from melting. Usually there's a winter thaw, in the middle of winter. We had a warm day for Super Bowl. That was it, and then we went back to freezing weather. So, what for SAD? I have an SAD light, that I wake up to in the mornings. I turn it on and, I read a little bit. On my iPad, I read the Wall Street Journal and I read news reports. Sometimes I post stuff on Facebook, before I get up, but I usually try to adjust a little bit to the gloom with a light that kind of wakes up my brain. Any other tips for?
Oh, that's a wonderful idea. Yeah, I'm a big fan of trying to get out into the daylight. One saving grace here is not every day is gray and cloudy and overcast. Otherwise, that would be really depressing. So even if it's very, very cold, very, very frigid, it's good to get outside and just to blink around in the sunlight a little bit, even though it's freezing.
Right. That's one of the reasons I walked to work this morning, just to get some light. And the streets were fairly empty. It was a holiday. So this program we recorded on President's Day. So the streets are fairly empty. And because subway service is a little unreliable in those kinds of days, I just walked to work the 2.5 miles or so. And got sunlight in my eyes, got some exercise, got some cold temperatures, which will rev my brown fat. I think exercise is a good way to overcome seasonal affective disorder.
That's true too. Having, first of all, making sure you're having your regular our regular sleep habits. Very, very important. You know, in weather like this, it can be hard to get up in the morning and so forth. It's so cold. And then by late, many people are even going to sleep earlier at night because there isn't too much to do.
Yeah. Well, that's as it should be. That's sort of Paleolithic, because in the darkness of winter, our caveman and woman ancestors they went to bed basically when it was dark and cold, and they spent a lot of time in virtual hibernation.
That's true. That's true. So a lot of couch potatoing for a lot of people, and hopefully all of this will break soon.
Right.
And we could just go run outside.
You know what I find helpful is that we concocted a few years back something, an amino acid concoction, which is 5-HTP tyrosine liquid. And it's something that I sometimes refer to as liquid courage, because, you know, as you well know, these are precursors to neurotransmitters in the brain. And when you're suffering from SAD or depression, you're just not making enough neurotransmitters. So instead of taking Zoloft or Lexapro, you can build up your neurotransmitters by taking a tablespoon or two of that a couple of times a day. That's actually, I mean, I find it helpful when I'm feeling a little bedraggled with the gloomy weather.
Are people actually being prescribed with antidepressants for SAD?
Oh, big time. You know, and it's, you know, but part of the problem is that it's not being recognized as such. They're saying, well, you know, you're just depressed. They don't bother to ask the question, is it seasonal? Could it be light related? But big time. I mean, I think that's a big component of depression. It's not the end all and be all of depression, but certainly here on the East Coast, a lot of people are feeling kind of bedraggled. And, you know, they're sedentary, they're bored, they're eating too much, they're not sleeping enough. And
that's a big problem with when people get cabin fever. There isn't much activity to do at home.
Right.
And a lot of people will find themselves eating or noshing out of boredom.
Yeah.
Which is, we have to watch that. That's why I say get outside, even when it's freezing.
And the other major antidote to seasonal affective disorder, beer. Or hard liquor.
Any kind of booze. Absolutely.
Hard liquor. I mean, you know, talk about, that's what they do up in the Arctic Circle, big time. You know, show me someone from the northern part of Finland, and I'll show you someone who likes to take their Jägermeister shots, especially during the winter months. Okay, so let's move on and talk a little bit about some of the questions we got this week. Why don't you?
Yeah. Let's see. I've got one here from Valerie. Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. Can you explain why it's helpful to eat nuts, particularly walnuts, even though nuts are extremely high in omega-6 oils? We're constantly told that the American diet is too high in omega-6 oils and that foods that contain it should be totally avoided. She also mentions in Grain Brain, Dr. Perlmutter says to purge your kitchen of just about all oils except for extra virgin olive oil, coconut, and sesame oils.
Wow.
At first I thought it must be the chemical reaction of heating the oils that causes him to say this, which is true, but he says to remove these oils from your kitchen, which must mean that they're dangerous to use even raw in salads.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He even puts grapeseed oil into this category. So why is it okay to use sesame oil when it's particularly high in omega-6, and why is it good to eat sunflower seeds, but not okay to use the sunflower oil in a salad? Once again, thanks so much for the wonderful podcast and the WOR radio show.
Well, my reaction to that is I sympathize with Dr. Perlmutter, because it's tough writing a book, and then you end up, you know, sometimes with contradictions in your book. And, I actually don't remember that part of the book. We've interviewed him a couple of times about Grain Brain, which is a terrific book. But, you know, the devil is in the details, and there are some nutty contradictions in that Valerie points out. Because,
yeah, that's true.
You know, if he wants to eradicate omega-6 oils, and I'm not sure even if that's a good idea, to eradicate omega-6 oils, then why is it okay to use sesame oil? It is relatively high, or it's very high in omega-6. And so
I agree. And I don't remember this part of the book either.
Right.
So, but Valerie's got an excellent question. Why is it good to eat sunflower seeds, but not okay to use sunflower oil in a salad? Mm-hmm. Here's the thing.
Yep.
Do you know how many sunflower seeds it takes to get a tablespoon of sunflower oil extracted, a whole lot.
Yep.
Way more than you would ever eat.
Right.
As a reasonable portion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the problems. We're not meant to be ingesting these omega-6 fats that way as an oil,
right,
but rather in the food that contains them. Don't you agree?
Oh, that's a very good point. And in fact, that's something that was pointed out by Lauren Cordain in his book, the first book, The Paleo Diet, is he said that our use of vegetable oils is an entirely novel thing. Because
yes,
they are industrially processed, they're pressed from nuts. And I wrote a very nice article for Mind Body Green. We've got, you know, thousands and thousands of hits on that article and lots of shares. 16 reasons to go nuts for nuts. And it contains a whole litany of reasons from a health standpoint to eat nuts, but not so much to have oil,
right,
from nuts, nut,
right,
oil. Nuts have more than just those oils. And, you know, we
there are
wanna
a lot of trace minerals,
yes,
in there, good source of magnesium, good sources of protein as well. And the other thing, you know, eat the sesame seeds, eat your walnuts, don't look for walnut oil. I wouldn't look for macadamia nut oil. Eat
mm-hmm.
your macadamia nuts. Honestly, quite honestly, we don't use olive oil that much for cooking at home.
Uh-huh.
Only if it's a, I mean, we really need to change. We really need to revisit, and I'm reminding myself that this is something I need to write about for the newsletter. We really need to change our methods of cooking. We have to braise more and maybe drizzle a little olive oil on it after it's finished cooking, not necessarily saute and use high heat, because even olive oil will get rancid. Even
yes.
olive oil is volatile. It's not just the corn oil, the canola, the grapeseed oil. Why do we hear so much about grapeseed oil? Because it has a very high smoke point, and for chefs and other people who love to cook, other foodies, it's a source of an oil that's not going to smoke too fast, and it can withstand high heat. However, just because it has a high smoke point doesn't mean it's not highly volatile. It's still volatile. It's not great for our health. That's really the bottom line. Now, coconut oil, this is where I would beg to differ. Coconut, because it's a saturated fat, one of the most saturated fats on the planet, along with palm oil, is that it's very stable under high heat. So that would be the one to use. Again, I'm not a huge fan of frying. We have to learn to braise more, steam, broil, roast, boil, all of that as well. So
mm-hmm.
we really have to, you know, this use of vegetable oils all over the place is
it's
kind
a big
of
problem.
Disturbing
yeah.
the more we learn about it. Yeah.
You know, just parenthetically, another thing that you get from nuts, not whole nuts but not the oils, are the plant phytosterols that are useful for reducing cholesterol. And in fact, plant phytosterols have been shown to be as effective as statin drugs in terms of prevention of cardiovascular disease. They're even
yeah.
endorsed by the American Heart Association. So adding nuts to your diet, even if you're a vegan vegetarian, you're on an ultra-low-fat diet and you add nuts, they're caloric, they contain a lot of fat, they actually improve your protection against cardiovascular disease. So
yeah.
that's a paradox. I mean, the nuts, which are oily and fatty, still, because whole nuts have a lot of different things in them, not just the oils,
mm-hmm.
they confer protection against cardiovascular disease. Now, if let's say we're into this 3-6 ratio, maybe you can talk a little bit about omega 3-6 ratio and which nuts to favor and which nuts to be a little bit more limited in consumption of.
Well, I'm still a fan of most of the nuts, not so much peanuts. Peanuts are actually really not a nut. They're a legume, but mm-hmm. let's just call it a nut, just because we're talking about it.
Right.
I love walnuts, macadamia nuts, pecans, hazelnuts, filberts. All of these are good to eat. Sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds, these are fine to eat. Don't use sunflower oil. Don't use safflower oil. These are some of the most pro-inflammatory, some of the most highest in omega-6. We want a good ratio, and a lot of these omega-6 fats we get primarily from vegetable oils as well as from grains, as well as from the factory farm meats whose animals are actually fed grain, and
mm-hmm.
that confers that to us as well, unfortunately. So we have to be able to strike a balance, and with our Stone Age ancestors, that ratio of omega-6 to 3 was more like 4 to 1 or 2 to 1. Here in our standard American diet, another sad acronym, right? We've got it. It's more like 20 to 1.
Yeah.
Or in some cases, really bad junk food diets, 50 to 1, that ratio, which is terrible.
Yep. And parenthetically, and we missed the best part here, Valerie writes, once again, thanks so much for the wonderful podcast and WR radio show. So we have, I mean, you know, it's in some ways, radio broadcasting is kind of a lonely business because, you know, we sit here and, you know, we're basically alone or we're on the phone together. We have no idea who we're reaching. It might be, on a given day, it might be no one. But then we discover, you know, that people are listening, and we look at the statistics, which, you know, at last glance, over 100,000 downloads per month on the podcast alone. That's not to mention the radio program. So we're ultimately having an impact with a lot of people, and that's good news. All right.
Yeah.
What else you got?
Let's see. We have another question from Eileen. She says, I read an op-ed piece in the New York Times recently in which the writer stated that a doctor had told her that eating kale, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, and broccoli was not a healthy choice for anyone with hypothyroidism, low thyroid. Hmm. I have hypothyroidism, but have never heard this. I tend to eat a fair amount of all the vegetables, including those listed. Do you have an opinion on this? Thank you in advance.
Okay. Well, we do have an opinion on that. Why don't you start?
Well, yes. The vegetables that Eileen mentions, interestingly, are of the genus Brassica. This is the plant family Brassica. And these Brassica family vegetables, kale, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, broccoli, I'll mention a few more, kohlrabi, watercress, cauliflower as well, these tend to be goitrogenic. And anything that's goitrogenic is inhibiting the action of thyroid, inhibiting the production of thyroid hormone. Now, should we never eat these vegetables? Oh, I don't know. Eating them in their cooked form is probably a little better than their raw form. What do you think, Dr. Hoffman?
Well, yes. I mean, clearly there is a problem with interference with thyroid hormone production, with overconsumption of cabbage family vegetables. And that would be Brussels sprouts, broccoli, cabbage, kale, collard greens, I believe, belongs to that category.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else? Kohlrabi, maybe?
Kohlrabi, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there is a case report. It's a remarkable case report. And, of course, it emanates from our hometown, Manhattan, where people go to great extremes in all manner of lifestyle choices. And there was a report of a woman who decided, and I believe she was of Chinese heritage. So this is down in Chinatown. And she believed for some reason that taking a lot of cabbage juice was going to be beneficial for her. And so she juiced cabbage and just guzzled enormous amounts of cabbage juice for a prolonged period of time. Well, she completely destroyed her thyroid. She had a TSH, I think, of 700 at the end of that, where normal is anything under than 4 or 5. And so this was in a medical journal. It was an extreme example of doing yourself in. And I believe it was either with the juice or it might have been with eating lots of raw cabbage. It might have been whole raw, but the key is that it was raw. It was also an enormous amount. And so what I say to patients who are on thyroid medication already, we know they already have hypothyroidism, is look, you know, your thyroid's already on the fritz. And by taking some small amounts of these, indole containing cruciferous vegetables, maybe there's a small chance you'll damage your thyroid further, but it's already on the fritz, and we can monitor your thyroid function and, if necessary, give you a little bit more thyroid medication. It's already broken, and it's just a matter of adding medication if it gets a little worse. We can always do that. There's so many benefits to cabbage family vegetables.
Oh, that's true. The cruciferous vegetables,
yeah,
they're loaded with. And I would never say to anyone, no, you should never eat these foods, but I might say to the person with hypothyroidism, you know what, you shouldn't have a kale smoothie every day.
Right, exactly.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Not every day. This is an argument, again, for variety in the diet.
By the way, kale salad.
With spinach.
Kale salad is huge now in Trader Joe's and in Whole Foods Market. There's a real resurgence of that because people want to really eat, you know, not just iceberg lettuce. They want high test greens. And mm-hmm. kale fits the bill. Young kale is sort of easier to chew than mature kale, so it makes a nice salad ingredient, but day in and day out, it might have a negative effect.
Exactly. And I would recommend, you know, what? Are you putting raw broccoli in your salad every day? Not only will that get boring, but you probably shouldn't have raw broccoli every single day in a salad. Vary it out. You know, vary it out. Use more salad vegetables from time to time, radishes, other things. And yes, eat your broccoli, but not in horrific, you know, ginormous amounts.
Right. And in fact, we have a supplement that we really like. Actually, several supplements that contain extracts of cabbage family vegetables. And they're not necessarily goitrogens because, they extract the cancer-fighting portions of these
vegetables.
The sulforaphanes. One is called Brocomax, which is sulforaphane glucosinolate, which is great for cancer prevention. Mm-hmm. We also have indole 3 carbonyl.
Indoles.
Right.
Right.
And we also have PhytoGuard. The product we have is called DimPro. The brand name of the product is called DimPro, which contains dimdiindolemethane and indole-3-carbinol. These are cancer-fighting compounds. And then there's PhytoGuard, which contains broccoli extract along with resveratrol and EGCG and quercetin and pomegranate extract. It's a great combo product for cancer prevention and just general protection. So we're not against those things, and we don't actually generally restrict those things from our patients who have thyroid problems.
Right. No, we don't, and I certainly don't. I think the biggest goitrogen to watch out for is soy.
Yeah.
More than anything.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, too much soy will definitely inhibit the uptake of iodine by the thyroid. The thyroid needs iodine to make thyroid hormone and all that, so... You know, I would avoid soy, or I would try to have the fermented version of soy, if you're a big fan, tempeh or something like that. Miso is fine as well. But should you have stir-fried tofu 5 days a week? No. Glasses of soy milk every day? No.
Exactly.
Yeah. But I would eat these vegetables. I would not eat huge amounts of them. I would have other vegetables, other salad vegetables as well, and just have a lot of variety.
Indeed.
Yeah.
All right, so I have one, which I saved over from last week. It's from Mike in New Orleans. Great, we have listeners in New Orleans.
New Orleans.
Dr. Hoffman, please discuss alpha-cyclodextrin, its attributes and deficiencies. Dr. Oz featured this on a recent show and claimed that it absorbs 9 times its weight in fat and then passes unabsorbed through the digestive tract without side effects. Thank you, Mike from New Orleans. So,
that's that calories product.
Yes, yes.
That fat blocker product.
So let me just say preliminarily that, I have tremendous respect for, Mehmet Oz. And in fact, I worked with him many, many years ago. I'd known him for a really long time. He's a fabulously talented individual. Great surgeon, great innovator, tremendously energetic, brilliant guy. However, that being said, I think the pressures of commercial broadcasting has required him to do cutting-edge shows, you know, just keep coming up with all this amazing new breakthrough, this, that, and the other thing. And unfortunately, the popular appeal is for magical weight loss ingredients. And so not a month goes by, especially during sweeps, then they don't do some program about some marvelous new ingredient for weight loss, you know, fat buster, you know, belly busters, things like that are hailed as panaceas for weight loss, on a program that is watched by tens of millions of people and is very influential and has got the credibility of a very fine physician at its helm. So that's a problem. And in fact, that's a problem that I haven't, it's not just my problem. It's a lot of people in the field of complementary and alternative medicine have highlighted this, and they've said, they've actually gone to the pains of writing a letter. I didn't sign the letter, but I saw the letter. To Dr. Oz, basically saying, look, we respect you. Thank you so much for getting the word out about this field of complementary and alternative medicine. But could you please do a little better vetting on some of these miracle products? Because, you know, you talk about this on TV, and then our patients come back to us and they say, I heard about it on Dr. Oz. And you know, they have to explain that it just isn't that facile, that you know, you have to do that hard slog. You know, diet, exercise, there's some things that help with metabolism. And we use some of those products like EGCG and Capsiate. Capsiate is an extract of hot pepper. We think it enhances metabolism a little bit. But, you know, in terms of these remarkable weight loss panaceas, some of this is, well, I would call it TGTBT, too good to be true. That's a whole,
that's true.
A whole category of nutrients, the TGTBT nutrient category.
And you know, this calories product is going to have side effects.
Well, I'm reading from it. I'm going to just read this to you. It says blocks up to 500 calories a day from food, and natural soluble fiber that binds to and eliminates up to 9 times its weight in fat and reduces calorie absorption by up to 500 fat calories a day. No side effects when taken as
a
drug.
I don't believe that.
It says
no
side effects. And it's no major lifestyle changes. And, yeah, okay, so, I mean, what could possibly go wrong here? What could possibly go wrong here?
Oh, well, let's count the ways. Wait. First of all, I would call this, or I think any nutritionist in his or her right mind would call this self-induced steatorrhea, meaning fat malabsorption, self-induced fat malabsorption. And what that means is, number one, we're not going to absorb our fat-soluble vitamins, our carotenoids, vitamin A, vitamin D, E, and K, right? That's one thing. But it's going to call for a lot of very, 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 excuse me, stinky poop.
Oh, yeah.
That's what steatorrhea is.
Or, as is sometimes delicately referred to as anal leakage.
Anal leakage,
you know,
yes.
We actually
imagine
had that
walking down the street.
Yeah, that's not too fun. And especially when you're wearing long underwear in the cold. Right. but here's the thing. This is not new. This is actually the basis of a product that has been much criticized. And I think it's virtually off the market. It was supposed to be this tremendous breakthrough many years ago, maybe a decade ago. It was called Olestra, and they were making Olestra potato chips. And basically
yes,
said you
I
could,
remember.
It's sort of like you can eat your cake and have it. You can have these fat and oil laden chips and it'll just pass harmlessly right through you. Well, it did. Yeah, to the embarrassment of many consumers of those products.
Yeah.
So it's a less, and here's the, I mean, as you know, the other thing, of course, is the nutrient depletions. What should address those?
Well, the fat-soluble vitamins, the vitamin A, E, you know, E, D, E, and K, number one. But listen, when we have a patient come in and they have steatorrhea, they have malabsorption in their GI tract, this is a problem. So that's why I call this self-induced. That's a problem that needs to be fixed, that needs to be rectified, so that patient, that client, will be able to absorb their nutrition the way they should.
Yeah, and especially
what this fat blocker is doing is terrible for health.
Yeah, and of course, could create an essential fatty acid deficiency. You won't, if as much as we really need
that's
the omega-3 fatty acids, you just will not absorb them. It'll block the absorption of useful fats, carotenoids,
so you could
lycopene.
Eat your salmon,
yeah.
Your salad with olive oil, your salmon, your nuts and your seeds, and you're going to block the absorption of all of those healthy fats, healthy nutrients, and all of that. That's terrible.
Right. Yeah, and you mentioned the alphabetic vitamins. I mean, other things that don't have alphabet names like lycopene and lutein, beta-carotene,
yes.
The carotenoids. These are all fat soluble. They're actually absorbed better with a little bit of fat. Ubiquinol or coenzyme Q10 is better absorbed with a fatty meal. So there are many fat soluble nutrients that might be interfered with. So, you know, I think it's a little irresponsible to get out there. I mean, I didn't see the segment. Yeah. So in fairness to Dr. Oz, I didn't see the segment.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, here's a guy and he's all fired up about this amazing nutrient. And, you know, people in the supplement industry have just said, man, there's just nothing like Dr. Oz. If you manage to get your product onto Dr. Oz, ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching. It's like hitting the jackpot. And,
yeah.
You know, my concern is that there are public relations people bombarding his show. And, you know, on a day where it's a slow news day or they don't have a feature and they're looking for something to put on, it could be just, okay, let the floodgates open and let's talk about something that's really exciting for the audience but maybe a disservice to the public.
Mm.
I mean,
unfortunate.
That's showbiz. I mean, I know how things work, and you know, we're certainly working on a much less commercial level where the pressures are less, fortunately, so that we can get. Look, if I were the host of Dr. Oz, the Dr. Oz show, some people say, why don't you do a show? You know, that show would flop immediately because I would get, people would ask me a question, and they'd say, what do you think of this amazing miracle weight loss nutrient? I go, well, on the one hand, yes, but on the other hand, the reason people would just like. Cricket sounds, you know, the TV sets all over America would switch to Judge Judy. Game
well,
over.
Here's the thing.
Game over.
The truth isn't always very sexy or entertaining,
yeah,
but it
I
is
know.
The truth, and it's what's important.
Well, we try to make it more sexy here. So
let's
make it. Put on your sultry voice.
Okay.
All right. So let's. Okay. Any. No, there are no sex questions? All right, what else we got here?
Do you have one?
I don't have one, no. Do you have one?
Oh, I've got one from Kate.
Okay.
Kate writes, want to ask you a question about what to eat at bedtime to prevent waking
That's sexy.
Up starving.
That's sort of sexy. That's not that sexy.
No, it's not. No. Kate says she used to eat cheese at bedtime, but now trying paleo and don't know what to eat. So.
Okay, well, that's a tough one. I mean, that's something you confront on a daily basis because I deal a lot with the medical aspects of people's health concerns. But when they see you, after they see me usually, this is something that you might have to deal with in the field. So what do you tell people who have this problem? You know, what's the ideal bedtime snack? Or is a bedtime snack even advisable? Or is there something else wrong that's causing them to crave a bedtime snack?
There's probably something else wrong. If anyone is waking up in the middle of the night starving, it has to be, most of the time, from unstable blood sugar.
Yes.
And the question to ask is, what am I eating, drinking, doing to destabilize my blood sugar in
during the day, earlier, as an antecedent,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So all day long, are you carb loading? Are you a carb addict? Kate, what are you eating? And then at 9 p.m., 2 hours before bed, or 1.5 hours before bed, you're having a hunk of cheese. That's not going to cut it. You need to be eating balanced all day long, always having some protein and fat portion with your carbohydrates. Now, when I say with your carbohydrates, I'm talking about the good ones, your starchy and non-starchy vegetables, your whole grains, all of those kind of things. That's really what we're talking about.
Right.
But I would wonder if Kate was hypoglycemic because it sounds like she's waking up in the middle of the night with low blood sugar.
There's this phenomenon of, I think it's called secondary meal tolerance or something like that, where your breakfast or the foods you have earlier in the day set up your metabolism and determine the degree to which you're going to have cravings, especially for sugar and carbohydrates. And if you have
That's
more
true.
Substantial foods earlier in the day and you stabilize your blood sugar, then you're going to have less tendency to really want to binge out late at night. I think bedtime snacks, in my opinion, are overrated. Because sometimes they say, well, have a little sugary thing because it'll put some tryptophan in your brain. Actually, carbohydrates tend to promote uptake of tryptophan into the brain where it can be made into serotonin, which is a relaxing effect. You know, that so-called the bedtime snack, a glass of milk and a, you know, cookie or something like that is thought to be an ideal way of getting tryptophan in your brain because the milk has the tryptophan and the cookie has the sugar and it puts that into your brain. The only problem with that is that, you know, could set you up for hypoglycemia later, you know, get a little sugar hit, and then a few hours later your blood sugar drops. And the other thing we're seeing, and I think you're a believer in this too, is that we should go longer periods of time without eating. That we should finish eating fairly early and then just stop eating, because there's a lot of aberrant eating that happens after dinner. You know, people come home, they're starved, they eat dinner at 6:30, they sit down, they turn on TV, they watch till like 11 o'clock. By, you know, the time the news is on, they're starved, they need a snack. You know, they go to the refrigerator, they have some ice cream, they have, you know, some cookies, so the Oreo cookies come out. And then also it's the time of day when you're just kind of like, you know, you're exhausted, you kind of, your resolve is just low, you're a little disinhibited. So that's when all people put the feed bag on. They have that so-called bedtime snack. That's not so great generally.
That's true. And I think people snuggle up to those cravings
near
bedtime, or it's the activity in front of the television. I hear this time and time again. Well, I need to nibble
on
something while I'm watching TV.
The ads don't help either.
Well, how about if you take up knitting or crocheting or doing a crossword puzzle or some other activity that's not food related? I
mean, right. So, to some extent, the longer we go without eating, the more you get into a calorie burn state.
And, that's right.
Not every time when you're hungry is that something to be obeyed, because as we frequently say here,
hunger is our friend.
Hunger is
Dr.
our friend.
Dr. Hoffman. Yes, that's what you said. Hunger is your friend.
Okay, I trademarked that. But the notion being that during the times when we experience hunger, these are actually times when our metabolism is seeking out our body fat and cannibalizing it, which is good for most of us to get rid of excess body fat. So, indeed, hunger is not necessarily a distress signal. It is your friend.
Yeah. And, you know, Western medicine says we shouldn't eat, you know, within 3 hours of bedtime. And, you know, ancient Chinese medicine says not within 5 hours of bedtime, which is interesting. And, you know, that whole thing about cutting back the 5 days on, 2 days off, all of that, where they're talking in the research about skipping breakfast.
Yep.
I find it's often, sometimes it works a little better to skip a dinner altogether. Say you have a late lunch at 2 or 3 in the afternoon. You could very well be done eating for the day, and that's perfectly fine. And then when you sleep that night, you probably won't wake up, because by that time you're in ketosis almost.
Yeah.
And that's just because we're not digesting all night long. And that's another thing that interrupts our sleep is that bedtime snack, especially if it's too heavy, and then we're digesting all night long.
Right. And, you know, it's a vicious cycle. You eat a big meal late at night, and then you don't want to really have breakfast until later, but then you're so darn hungry that you eat it, you know, you get into this vicious cycle of eating later and later. And it's best to leave a little room so that when you wake up, you got a little room for breakfast before you have to rush off to work. All right. I wrote a whole article on the breakfast debate. You can find it at MindBodyGreen. You can also find it at drhoffman.com. Our website just up, by the way, the new revised drhoffman.com. And we got lots of stuff there, contributions from Layla and yours truly. And we also curate articles from other distinguished folks in the field of nutrition and medicine. drhoffman.com. Any more questions? We have someone on garlic, right?
Yes. As a matter of fact, this is from Mike. Dear Layla and Dr. Hoffman, I'm a bit confused about what form of garlic is most healthful. What is the difference between eating raw garlic and garlic that has been slightly heated in oil, or heated more so in, say, olive oil, and finally really heated in an oven that's in food or in oil as well? That sounded all a little confusing, but he meant whether it's heated in an oven in your food or heated, sautéed a little bit in a pan. Are there different health benefits from the same garlic taken from different temperatures?
Right.
I happen to like all forms of garlic, whether raw or cooked, so I'd like to know what forms of garlic would be most beneficial. Do any of the chemicals in raw garlic decompose or rearrange themselves during the heating process? How are, you know, are these new chemical products still beneficial or effective?
Well, that's a thoughtful question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love garlic in all forms, too. I agree with Mike. But I think the most potent chemical in garlic that's beneficial is the allicin, A-L-L-I-C-I-N.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as cooking, I have to be honest, I'm not sure what the cooking would do to the Allison. Do you have an idea?
Yeah, I think that there is some degradation or destruction of the Allison when you cook garlic. But there are innumerable compounds in garlic besides the Allison. Allison is actually responsible to some extent for its anti-infective properties, antifungal, mm-hmm. antibacterial, even antiviral properties. And it's highly touted. But, you know, they're really... In the field of nutrition, there are many controversies, and garlic is no exception. And the garlic wars have been fought over, you know, it's kind of like the Punic Wars, the garlic wars. The garlic wars have been fought over Allison, because there's another major type of garlic product, which is, aged garlic extract.
Yeah.
Kyolic makes it, and there's virtually no Allison in it. And their claim is that, you know, okay, fine, there's no Allison in it, but there are enormous numbers of sulfhydryl compounds in there that are very helpful for cancer prevention, for immunity, for cardiovascular purposes, that are brought out through an exclusive ancient fermentive process. So they take the garlic and they... You know, according to traditional fermentive processes, the Japanese are very good at fermentation. They make great beer and miso and pickled products. They transform the garlic and they may concentrate some of its beneficial factors. So they've done a lot of research, more research probably than any other garlic company in the world, and the statistics are amazing because they show things, for example, that if you take kyolic aged garlic extract along with a statin, you get about 30% more protection than with a statin alone. I mean, that would be great.
Wow.
You know, that's for all the people out there concerned about cardiovascular risk. You don't have to stop taking your statin if you have to take a statin, but take some kyolic along with the statin. So look, I think we've got to hedge our bets here. It's kind of like, you know, have raw garlic. Absolutely. Have, you know, cooked food with garlic. And consider aged garlic extract as a daily supplement. I take it every day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Fermentation is wonderful. Like, you take cabbage and you ferment it to make sauerkraut, mm-hmm. and you basically increase the vitamin C by 10 times. And that's the fermentation that's doing that. So it's fascinating about all of that. Well, anyway, lots of good food things to know. Sauerkraut, kimchi, pickles, all of these things that are fermented, especially a lactic acid fermentation in pickles, not just sitting there in a vinegar brine or something like
mm-hmm.
that. So, mm-hmm. yeah. Food is medicine.
Absolutely. So, any other questions that we have to address?
We have... one more, and this is taken from a blog from the New York Times. Pamela writes, can anyone speak to the comment pasted below that was written in response to the New York Times article about the new recommendation for fluoride toothpaste in children under 2?
Hmm.
Or any other plausible reason why there might be so many underperforming thyroids these days? Let me give a little background if you haven't read this New York Times blog.
Sure.
The new recommendation now is used to be once children are 24 months old, a pea-sized dollop of toothpaste and start brushing their teeth. Now they're recommending as soon as those teeth erupt in an infant to start using toothpaste.
Hmm.
And I think the concern here is that baby can't spit. What if they're absorbing that fluoride,
exactly.
and what may be the impact to thyroid?
Right.
That's the basic gist of the question.
Well, you know, the chemically, and I think this listener pointed it out because I read the question beforehand, chemically, fluoride and bromide occupy the same column in the periodic table as iodine. So they may have a blocking or interfering effect on iodine, which is essential for the thyroid. So you could envision a scenario where people are getting adequate iodine, which we know is essential for the thyroid, but it's being blocked by bromide. Bromide is present in commercial flour products, particularly brominated flour. And then chlorine, that's another one, by the way. Chlorine is also in that same column. Is present
yeah.
in water. And then fluoride, we give extra fluoride. So we're really blocking the iodine, and we may be setting kids up for thyroid problems later in life. Look, there's other toxic effects of fluoride. Here's my take on that. Remind me, another reason why I just am continually disappointed by the New York Times, but that's neither
yeah.
here nor there. what I really like, and this has actually been tried out in entire countries, countries have adopted this, instead of fluoridating their water, they've been using xylitol in their toothpaste. It's a harmless sugar-like substance that is non-caloric and doesn't make you fat, and it actually inhibits bacterial growth in the mouth. Now, we use it in a nasal spray called Clear Nasal Spray, spelled with an X, X-L-E-A-R, because it inhibits bacterial and fungal overgrowth in the sinuses. But in the mouth, it inhibits the overgrowth of the bacteria that are responsible for cavities. And after instituting it in, they've done it in two countries. I think it was Costa Rica and in Finland as part of a public health program. They had a remarkable decrease in cavities in kids and ultimately in adults. And it wasn't about fluoride. And fluoride, you know, fluoride is big business in America. It's a toxic byproduct of aluminum production. We have a ton of fluoride sitting around, so we just dump it in our municipal water supplies. And instead of being a toxic industrial waste, it turns out to be a product that you can sell to state and local governments. But, you know, I just am not keen on fluoridating. And, oh, by the way, you know, between the water and the food, beverages that contain fluoride, we're probably just exposing ourselves to too much fluoride.
That's true.
Not
no,
too
much. I would agree with that, yeah.
So that's my take. All right, did you get time to mention our upcoming, we're very excited about, by the way, about this next one.
Our next seminar, The War on Natural Medicine. It's Wednesday, February 26th. That's next week, Wednesday, February 26th from 6 to 8. It is filling up. I would urge you, if you want to reserve your seats, please call us, 212-779-1744.
And why we're doing this?
Lots of new material, yeah.
Why we're doing this, we're mad as hell, and we can't take it anymore because of all these,
absolutely.
All these negative stories.
I'm livid.
Yeah, and so we've got a lot of ammo to fire back at the detractors of supplements. And those of you who take supplements, and if you're concerned, you want to get the 411 on the real story, the careful analysis of the studies that purport to show that supplements are worthless. We've done our homework. We're going to put it together for you in a short, concise presentation. We'll be there to answer your questions. So mark it down on your calendars. Please try to join us. Call the Hoffman Center for information and for reservations. Well, that's it.
That's it.
That's all. That's all she wrote.
Okay.
All right. There's silence on the line. All right, so very good. Thank you very much, Layla. And
thank you for having me.
Let's hope it doesn't snow too much tomorrow.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, we will trudge our way
forward
to the office. We will turn on our SAD lights and our snow boots, and we will trudge forth one more time.
Yes, and it's only four more weeks till spring.
Maybe.
Maybe, I know.
All right. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks for joining us. This is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. You've just listened to a free podcast brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. F-R-E-E is my favorite four-letter word, but these podcasts do involve time and money to produce. And so in the spirit of defraying some of our very real production costs and to keep these podcasts flowing, I'd like to ask you to consider a couple of things. First, if you like what you're hearing, please share these podcasts with your friends and relatives. Our object is to continue the spectacular growth of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast with the goal of attaining 250,000 podcast downloads per month in 2014. I know that with the help of dedicated listeners like you, it'll happen. Second, go to drhoffman.com and click on the store and consider buying your supplements via a convenient internet portal or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements that I talk about here on Intelligent Medicine and that I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center. And finally, consider becoming a patient at the Hoffman Center. I can personally perform an extensive workup on you, applying all the intelligent medicine principles that you hear about on these podcasts, or alternatively, make an appointment with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on Intelligent Medicine, and she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Anyway, thanks for listening and continue enjoying our Intelligent Medicine podcasts.